I'm Amy Halpern-Laff.
And I'm John Moskow. Our guest today is Dr. Anthony Johnston. Dr. Johnston is an associate professor of education at the University of St. Joseph in West Hartford, Connecticut. His most recent book is Introduction to Secondary Teaching, Blending Wisdom, Research, and Social Justice. This is Anthony's third visit to the show. Welcome back, Anthony.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here. It's great to see you both.
The subtitle of your book is Blending Wisdom, Research, and Social Justice. Can you tell us why you chose this subtitle and what it tells us about the book?
Absolutely. I really found that there was a lot of scholarship out there in the realm of social justice sort of pedagogy. We can certainly look at resources that talk about evidence-based practices. Adolescent brain research, there's a lot of really amazing things that have come out, especially since 2014 around that particular area. And then, of course, teachers' wisdom of practice, the wisdom that we gain from teachers, which is something that absolutely needs to be valued and part of the conversation. And I find myself going through all of those spaces in my role as a teacher educator, working with secondary teachers and pulling works from people I really admire and respect. And I was thinking about the ways in which these different sort of, I call them strands, scholarship strands in education, kind of talk to each other. And I wanted to think about a way to bring them all to, I think of it as like sitting all around the dinner table and discussing the work of teaching and having different perspectives and different foundations and different theories and different values, and really having them sit in the messiness of it and look for some shared ideas and some ways in which they connect, but also explore the contradictions and so forth. So I argue that teaching is a very complex activity. And in order for us to really engage in a thoughtful discussion on how to teach, I would argue we need to enter into that sort of space of dissonance around these questions of wisdom of practice, social justice pedagogy, the evidence-based practices work, and the adolescent brain research. And that's why I brought all four of those together to try to produce a book on teaching that could hopefully speak to people in different ways, but also complicate some things that maybe we take for granted a little bit.
The Trump administration has recently declared that teachers are not professionals. This can affect funding sources for professional education. Does demoting teacher status and autonomy represent a broader socio-political change?
It does. It's not out of step, certainly, with this current administration across numerous fields and sort of anything that has to deal with sort of anti-intellectualism and so forth. It seems to be a big part of their charge. And that's seen at the K-12 level, but certainly also in higher education. But I would argue that sometimes we have to, you know, hit rock bottom. And I feel like in some ways we are pretty close to that, if not there, in some ways, when it comes to how we treat and view the teaching profession, even before they made that decision to deprofessionalize the work of teachers. And I argue in my book that this is actually a time for teachers. We have the research now that really indicates that teaching is the most effective resource for effective student learning. And so we really want our students to learn and to grow and to engage and to have agency and to have possibility and see themselves as learners, then we really need to empower teachers more than ever. And we've seen that the technology that we've tried to be the, you know, make that the silver bullet or the new app or whatever it might be, is nothing compared to the power of a highly qualified teacher in the classroom. So if we can embrace that, and that's what this book does, it talks a lot about that, as well as what that should mean and the high expectations we should have for teachers and so forth, then I hope that we can start to rebuild the sense of professionalization that teachers enjoy and that our larger society values and appreciates. So it's a pendulum swing, and we're at one end of a pendulum right now. And I'm hoping that my book and many others that do a lot of really great work can help to sort of go the other direction, and we begin to value teachers for the work that they do. I'll just say quickly, we're at a place right now where so many people who argue that anybody can be a teacher, and I often talk about this with my students, some politicians tend to think that way because they themselves were students, right? And so they have all those years, just like all of us, all those years of having gone through school, and we think that we know what it is that teachers do. But what teachers do in front of the classroom is really only about 25% of their jobs. And the other thing is, just because you've been a student in a class doesn't mean you know how to teach. I had to get a lot of work done on my teeth when I was a kid. I had a good 10 years of sitting in the orthodontist chair. But I can promise you don't want my hands in your mouth fixing your teeth. So it's to me, it's the same thing with politicians and p other people who say, oh, anybody can be a teacher because they went to school. And I think that's the kind of rhetoric that really disrespects teaching and really kind of shines a light on the lack of value we put on schooling in this country. We have moved to a space in which we have de-skilled teachers. And part of that is through the result of standardized testing and the emphasis on handing them scripted curriculum and sort of taking a lot of the teachers' work out of their hands. But I also feel like we've reached a point where we see how that's problematic. And I'm hoping that we can kind of rebuild the skills of teachers. And that's something that I talk about in the book, to being the professionals and effective teachers that our students need.
You begin your book talking about three essential elements of teaching not generally covered in teacher education programs, for which you use an acronym, TIPS, TIPPS, teacher identity, teacher presence, teacher passion, and teacher stance. Could you talk a little bit about these?
Absolutely. So these are four, to me, they're their foundation, right? So I think of teacher identity, teacher presence, teacher passion, teacher stance, and I'm going to talk about them together first, and then I'll talk about them individually. They are like, and I talk about it in the book this way, they're sort of like the base of a dish. Like when you're cooking and you want a good, you need to make a good roux first, right? If you're baking, Southern New Orleans style food, you want to have that good base, that good foundation. And chefs know how to do this, good cooks know how to do this. And to me, the TIPS is the roux of all the teaching practices that happen in the classroom. And if you've got that foundation down, and sometimes you develop it as a new teacher, but I think teacher education programs need to start to develop it, at least in teachers, they'll be more effective sooner and they'll be less likely to leave the classroom within the first 3 years, when there's a high percentage of teachers who do. I always say it takes 5 years to become a good teacher. Too many teachers leave before they have the chance to find out that they're actually great teachers. And I think part of that is on us as teacher educators, is to provide them a better foundation to get through those first few years. So TIPS works together in this way. Teacher identity is the sense of what we think a teacher is, and that's informed by our own experiences as a student, but also media representations informed by all the books we read in our teacher education program, our idea of what a model teacher might be and who we are as a teacher. We have a take a reflective stance and think about our own practice and what do we need to do to get to that model idea of the kind of teacher we want to be. So a lot of that is teacher identity. I know for myself, for example, this is giving my age away a bit. I love the, like a lot of people, the Dead Poets Society and the Robin Williams portrayal. And I thought that was the teacher I wanted to be. And I came to realize that good teaching is not when you blow students' minds. Good teaching is when you give students the power to blow their own minds. And I think that that's, to me, the shift I made in part of my own teacher identity. Teacher presence is one of the more complicated ones that don't really get talked about at all in teacher education programs. I equate it to actor presence in the sense of when somebody's involved in acting, and that's my background's in theater, when they're on totally immersed in a scene and they're fully committed to the objective of the scene and they're totally connected with their scene partner and they're listening and they're reacting. They lose any kind of sense of the fact that they're acting in that moment and they're so fully engaged. It's like they're like jazz musicians, to use another analogy, sort of all working together collectively. And I think that teacher presence is when a teacher is so fully invested in the act of teaching, right? When in psychology, we talk about it like as flow, where you sort of raise all the standards and expectation and all, and your own ability arises to meet the moment. And so that means they're connected to what's going on for each student. They're making a thoughtful and compassionate best next step in terms of their choices as a teacher. They're able to hold the whole class in their hand, as well as see them as individuals and think about what's going on for each student. So that teacher presence is a powerful thing. And when we can experience it, and I think a lot of teachers have experienced it, maybe not with that, using that word, but it's one of the very rewarding aspects of teaching. Teacher passion is really the why of teaching, right? And this kind of comes out of Robert Fried's work, this idea of I'm going into teaching, especially in secondary, because I'm passionate about students, passionate about adolescents, either as a group or, who they are just as individuals. Sometimes my passion is rooted in my content area, my love for social studies or for science or math. And sometimes that passion comes from larger social justice, maybe issues happening in the world, concerns about the planet, things like that. That motivates me to be a science teacher to help young people understand. So those passions, and I would add a fourth one to his model and say, there's also people who just have a passion for the action, for the everyday mundane tasks of teaching, that there can be a great passion that comes with, maybe it's how they greet their students at the door and how they organize their room and sort of things like that. That I know a lot of teachers who really love that part of it. And that passion can change over the years, and there's times when our focus may be more on one than the other, but that holding on to that passion is really key to sustaining this work. And the last one is teacher stance. And this has some parallels with the passion piece. But for me, teacher stance is about what do you see as your charge? What do you see as your job? And how do you mentally prepare yourself to carry out that charge when you walk into a classroom? And then paired with that is how do you see your students? What do you see them as being capable of? And that stance is really important because when we have high expectations for ourselves and we have high expectations for our students, then it fuels our teacher passion. It helps add to our teacher presence. Over time, it shapes our identity as teachers. So I see all these things as sort of interwoven and connected, and sometimes they contradict, right? There are certain times when our stance is, oh my God, I can't. This class I'm teaching today has been driving me crazy. And when you have that, you need to be a reflective practitioner in that moment and say, whoa, like my stance right now is not really in a good place if I'm going to best serve my students. So that whole notion of tips is something that I think we can teach more and help prepare new teachers to be effective in the classroom on day one.
Anthony, you've had quite a bit of experience in more progressive coalition schools, but you've also discussed some positive developments in more traditional district schools. Could you discuss this and maybe provide some examples?
Absolutely. I think about my own background was I had the pleasure of teaching as part of the Coalition of Essential Schools, first in the South Bronx in my student teaching year at Fannie Lou Hamer Freedom High School, before I went on to teach in the Bay Area at Leadership High School and both of those were great experiences and truly changed what I thought education looked like based on my own experience going through the public school system in San Francisco when I was a kid. And I didn't, it made me very excited to be a teacher. A big part of what I loved about it was how collaborative all the adults were in the space. It was this sort of, yeah, maybe it tapped into my joy of having done theater and working with others to put a show up on its feet. But we all were just coming in every day and trying to figure out how are we going to best serve our students and teach our content and work together to sort of help have a school be a space where students felt like they had a home away from home and were held to high expectations and so forth. And that energy, that space, that work that we did, I thought was really, really powerful and shaped me in many ways. But I also think there were some certain fundamentals to teaching and assessment and supporting students beyond just making them feel great, which is really important, but some fundamental skills sometimes that we didn't always follow up on. And I really value what I see in a lot of sometimes more traditional schools where there is more structure and there is more support and some clarity around what they're asking of students. And so, kind of like how I talk about blending the wisdom of practice and social justice and evidence-based research, I think there are so much that we can take from different schools and look at, okay, this might not be the school I would want to attend personally, but what can I draw for? I might not want to teach in this particular school, but what can we learn from this school? And what can we learn from this other type of school and sort of bring these together to talk about how we best support students? For too long in education in general, whether it's because of some of the traditions or, the school choice movement that has caused a lot of this to happen, we're just talking in our own silos, and there's a lot to be gained, I think, in different types of ways of teaching students. I mean, schools that are teaching students outdoors and schools that are having students work in jobs part of the day. Like, I mean, there's so many different models that exist out there, but they don't really work. To me, they're not really in conversation with each other enough in ways that could best support students.
Dr. Elizabeth Moje, the Dean of the School of Education at the University of Michigan, was a guest on the show last April. Dr. Moje distinguishes between teaching with social justice and teaching for social justice. What does this distinction mean to you?
I love her work, and I'm going to have to go back and listen to that podcast now. So teaching with social justice and teaching for social justice for the context of this book, especially as I think about working with people who are going into teaching, I really want teachers who are fired up to teach for social justice reasons to have a path forward. And I think it can be hard to have that in this current political climate that we're in. I know that folks in some parts of the country are surrounded by folks who are working hard to teach for social justice, right? Places like New York and Chicago and the Bay Area and places like that. But I also know that there are a lot of places that teachers may have that desire and may not be in a place that's conducive to it based on the politics of that district or that school or that state. And so that's where I feel teaching with social justice really comes in. I think a teacher has to focus in on what would it mean to help our young people have agency, have engage in critical thinking, engage in creative work, engage in inquiry, all in ways that to me speak to social justice. When you have students who have historically been marginalized by education and they've been just handed worksheet after worksheet and they've been passive recipients to their educational experiences, well, anything that it moves beyond that is teaching with social justice, right? Because we're trying to help these folks develop that sense of agency in their lives so that, as I said earlier, they can do the work to save themselves. And teaching for social justice often looks like being more explicit about here's what we're saying is happening in the world, and these are these issues that we need to address, and we're going to address them and talk about them in this classroom. And whether it's the things that are happening in Minnesota or whether it's things that are happening with the environment or so forth, those are spaces where teachers have the power to sort of step forward and say, we're going to talk about this and tackle this and look at it from all different angles and look at all the data and look at what the research says and come up with sort of creative and critical thinking solutions to these issues. That to me is teaching for social justice.
So, how can teachers make sure that they're not penalizing students for views that they find offensive?
Well, they should absolutely not be penalizing students for views that they might find offensive. At first, I thought you were saying it the other way around, because I think it tends to be more the case that when people talk about politics in the classroom, they're thinking, we don't want teachers to bring their own views into the classroom, that they should be penalized for that if that happens, which I totally disagree with. But with regards to students' perspectives, teachers know that where those views are coming from, right? And often they're coming sometimes from parents, but often sometimes also just from the social media that they're engaging in and the talk shows they're listening to and the podcasts and so on and so forth. So the job of the teacher is not to tell the students you should be penalized for having that perspective, but to help them think about it more critically and to consider alternative viewpoints and weigh the data and really help them to step back and really think about where their stance is on that particular topic.
If teachers share their own core beliefs with their students, how can they make sure students aren't afraid to disagree with them?
When you say core beliefs, you're talking about sort of their values
Their
and so forth.
values,
Yes. Okay.
exactly.
So one thing I asked my students in an early class in our education program at USJ is I asked them, should teachers bring their politics into the classroom? And 99% of them will say no. And the reason I think for that is that when we hear that statement, we have a tendency to think it means they're going to come in and they're going to say, I voted for so and so. And if you didn't vote for this person, then there's something wrong with you. You know, and then there's a whole power dynamic at play and so on and so forth, which is really problematic. But I try to point out to my students that politics is always in the classroom. Politics is always present in the classroom. Every single curriculum that you're going to look at was vetted through all sorts of political parties along the way, boards of ed. The books that you are assigning to your students went through a whole political process to be chosen to be on that bookshelf for you to be able to provide to your students. Anything with regards to, heck, all the way up to school lunches. There's not really an aspect of schools that doesn't involve political choices. To me, a big one is the fact that, you know, we have a lot of really new teachers who are being given very difficult classes in their first year or so, rather than having really strong teachers take on those more difficult classes. And that to me is another example of politics. So politics is always present in the classroom. If we start with that, we can then say, and I also want a teacher who is trained to work with adolescents, who understands adolescent brain development, who understands what young people are going through, is trained to be able to help people see multiple sides of an issue, who is able to hold space to have hard conversations sometimes that require being empathetic and compassionate listeners and engaging in constructivist listening and so forth. Teachers are all trained to do that. And I want, that's the adult that I would want my students having conversations with around these tricky topics that maybe people have different, you know, values around and different core beliefs about. So that seems to me a no-brainer, that that's what teachers should be able to do, and we should be sure that we are preparing them to do that. And in other spaces in their lives, they're not likely to come across that level of sort of thoughtfulness and consciousness of their audience in so many other spaces that might be trying to sell you something, or that might be trying to just sort of encourage listeners and things like that, that don't necessarily want to embrace all the different sides of an issue. That seems to me, the classroom seems to me the best space to have those kinds of hard conversations around core values.
Given the differences in cultural capital with which students come into the classroom, how do we grade?
Well, I generally think that we should think about grading with regards to who that student is and where that student is at and meet them there. I don't tend to like the idea of a classroom where there's a certain amount of A's to give out, and some people are going to get them and some people are not. If you're using sort of a mastery-based approach and you're helping students to move forward along a continuum in terms of their growth in that particular area, then their assessment should be based on their own effort, their own work they put in, their own growth. And while they may not necessarily meet the standard totally that you're trying to help them to get to, they should be recognized and rewarded for the work that they do. And then they may need additional support going forward to move to actually reach that particular standard. But I think it needs to be individualized. It needs to not be a situation in which students are competing for grades or anything like that, but should be an atmosphere. I mean, I always promoted an atmosphere in my classroom that we're all, the goal in this class is for everyone to get an A, but you're going to all have to not only work really hard, but also support each other to get to that point. And so that's where the social responsibility piece comes in, is we're all in this together and we have to move towards a system, I think, and I think the Coalition of Essential Schools was really good about this, having this sense of this isn't just about me, it's about us as a community. And when students go to school and they experience that in their classrooms, hopefully they carry that mentality and that sense of something larger than themselves once they go out and participate in a democracy. And as Dewey talks about, sort of being engaged and active citizens who are participants and who think about the larger community and not just themselves, that can happen if we move away from this competitive view of how we should do grades and classes.
Grades do serve a purpose of helping colleges to sort out students, right? So I'm wondering, what that looks like when you're giving essentially an E for effort.
No, I'm not saying to give an E for effort. I'm saying that we need to have high expectations for all of our students, but we also know that all of our students aren't starting at the same place. And so I've been in plenty of classrooms where I see students who are really strong and who come in having, they read a certain amount of books, things like that. So their ability to read the book that's assigned is pretty much a breeze for them. They go through the whole class, they get an A, and they haven't worked hard at all, and they haven't learned very much at all. So that's a concern as well, right? But with regards to your question about the colleges, this is a really tough space we find ourselves in. Like, my own daughter is currently hearing from colleges right now about whether or not she's been accepted into schools. And we had a time period that we're still sort of in with the sort of test optional choice for colleges in terms of whether or not students should submit their SAT scores. And there was some research recently done that suggests that grades are not a good evaluator of whether or not students are going to do well in college. That the part of the problem for that is because there are so many schools where students are getting grades they maybe should not be getting. I can tell you, being around districts where there's privilege, there's a whole lot more pressure by parents on teachers for children to get certain grades. Coming in and saying, "Well, I know you gave my child an A minus, but I need them to get this A because they're trying to reach to get into this school," and so on and so forth. When I was teaching high school, I never once had a conversation like that in my entire 10 years. In part because I don't think the parents, the students that I was teaching, felt like they had the right to come into a teacher and tell them, "You need to give my child this particular grade." So it's a really messy, complicated system that we have right now with regards to grades. It leaves colleges in a difficult spot in terms of how well they can assess a student's application. They put a lot of emphasis on the personal essay, which I think is good. But then, of course, with AI and things like that, there's all kinds of questions with regards to that. So we're in a tricky spot in terms of college acceptances and how students should be evaluated. And I think things like a more holistic approach that they're taking in terms of ways that students can be involved in different activities and jobs and so forth is really good. Interviewing students, I think, is a great idea. And really getting a sense, and I think teachers' letters of recommendation can be helpful. So there's a wide range of things that colleges look at. And both grades and test scores have been put under scrutiny quite a bit.
You mentioned Robert Fried, and in the book you quote him in The Passionate Teacher, asking if a school board decreed that the final exam had to be given a year after the course was completed, would that change how you teach? What are some of the ways you think that that would affect teaching?
I love that quote. And I used his book for years as a teacher. I think that kind of speaks to what Amy was just asking about as well. It's just, how do we reimagine what assessment might look like? And how can we do it in a way that allows us to have a more sort of thoughtful and complete and complex view of each individual student beyond just a mark on a paper? Grading has historically been a very, and assessment in general, has historically been a very tricky topic for teachers. We struggle to even know what we're talking about when we talk about grades and we talk about assessment, I would argue. An assessment can be how somebody does on a quiz, but an assessment can also be, how do I read that student when they walk into the classroom and look at how they have their head down and they're kind of dragging their feet? I'm going to assess them in that moment and I'm going to engage in assessment and figure out what's going on for them. So assessment just as a term itself has different meanings depending on the context. I think that one of the problems that I've always had with assessments as it relates to grades is that it's often based on, we'll use different point scale systems, right? The 0 to 100 scale, and anything less than I think it's like a 62 is an F. And that whole, the mathematics behind that, many of people have demonstrated, and I talk about it in the book, that that model penalizes students in ways that are really problematic. Like there's a formula that I share where if a student has a series of B's and maybe a couple of C's, and then they get one F, that brings their overall score down, their overall points average down to such a low place that it would take like eight more A's and B's in a row to kind of get just back up to like a C. So that kind of, to me, it's always just been very weird and arbitrary. And I'm be honest, and I'm speaking for myself, I have had years where I was teaching, and this is before everything was based on computer systems and so forth. But even there, how do you rig that system? So I would have a year where I taught a class and I realized a student got a B minus, that if I had used the grading system I had used the year before, that same student may have gotten a C plus. And that just feels weird to me. Like if they had done the exact same performance, and that arbitrariness can be seen across schools and across districts, even within schools. One teacher might have a special policy for participation points. Another one may have something where they have a late policy that's their own. So all of these things are so random, and it really calls into question the authenticity of these grades and these assessments. And then that even doesn't even take into consideration what you raised in the beginning around the different capital that students have access to. And so students may go home to a household in which they have a lot of support to complete their homework assignments and so forth. Other students may not. Some students may have experiences and backgrounds and cultural experiences that might allow them to complete work that might be completely unusual and different and foreign to some students. So those things that we've always known are present also play a role. And so my personal view is that we have to think about some of the more, there are some really great new ways of thinking about grading, such as sort of using the 1 through 4 scale is one system that some schools have moved to that I think is a more mathematically effective way of thinking about it. Some teachers will drop the lowest score, for example. And I think one of the things that we did at the Coalition School was if a student had made an effort but still failed, but we saw that they at least tried, we gave them what was called a not to standard. And then they would have like 6 weeks to complete work that would allow them to then eventually get a C in the class. So they could still get credit for the work they did, but they had to show and demonstrate to us that they had learned the material. So there are ways and systems that can be
And just
used.
for listeners who may not be familiar with it, what is the 1 to 4 system?
It's basically rooted in the sort of mastery-based grading program that some schools have moved to that really looks at standards and sort of says you have to meet this standard before you can move forward. And their performance is based on that. And you're like, okay, so you're at a 2, which means let's get you at least to a 3. And they'll continue to work with them till they get to that 3 before they move on to sort of the next step in that curriculum. So when students have assessments that are beyond obviously standardized testing, but even just giving them a test at the end of a unit based on all the material that was taught or the book that they read, that rarely is the thing that they come and tell you after their senior year of high school that you gave them when they were freshmen. That was the thing that they're going to carry with them for the rest of their lives. But if you are a teacher who engages students in project-based learning, inquiry-based learning, presentations that involve an authentic audience, things like that, those are the sorts of experiences and assessments that they will remember a year from now and maybe even further into their lives about what they learned from doing that experience, both the content and the skills that were involved to be able to successfully complete it.
Thank you, Anthony Johnston, author of Introduction to Secondary Teaching, Blending Wisdom, Research, and Social Justice.
Thank you.
And thank you, listeners. If you found this podcast worthwhile, please share it with friends and colleagues. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and give us a rating or review. This helps others to find the show. Check out our website for more episodes and videos, and subscribe to our monthly emails. We post annotated transcripts of our interviews to make them easy to use in workshops or classes. Contact us at hosts@ethicalschools.org. We're on Blue Sky, Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and LinkedIn. Our editor and social media manager is Amanda Denshi. Until next time. Thank you.